Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the May 29th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a young family in a blue sedan. They've got all their gear strapped on top. The license plate on the front says refu.GEE1. The husband and wife have their masks pulled down from their mouths. The husband is holding his breath. The wife is wiping her brow. The two kids are looking forward through the window. The dog is hanging his head out the window with his tongue wagging in the breeze. And the title is Exodus, the pandemic-driven flight of city dwellers to towns and suburbs. And I think we picked that up on the Talking Points page, but we'll start, as usual, with the main stories and how they were covered. A cautious return to the new normal. What happened? America's reopening gathered speed this week as all 50 states loosened restrictions and citizens weary of lockdowns began to emerge, leaving anxious public health officials watching for signs that a surge of infections will follow. As confirmed COVID-19 cases swelled to 1.6 million nationwide and deaths surpassed 94,000, some states took tentative steps toward reopening the economy, while others, in defiance of guidelines calling for a steady two-week decline in infections, threw open the doors. Alaska announced a full return to business with bars, theaters, and gyms open at full capacity. Connecticut allowed museums and offices to reopen. Auto plants resumed operations in Michigan and Illinois. A partisan split continued with blue states moving more cautiously than red ones. But even in hard-hit and deep blue New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio said restrictions would start lifting in June, and a balmy weekend saw crowds gather to sip takeout drinks on sidewalks in front of bars. Infectious disease experts cautioned it will be weeks before we see the impact of reopening. Georgia and Florida, among the first states to reopen, faced questions about their data reporting. In Florida, a health official was told to resign for insubordination after she said she refused to post false numbers on a state website to drum up support for the plan to reopen. In Georgia, embarrassed officials took down a misleading chart that wrongly suggested cases were steadily declining. Meanwhile, governors were torn between the need to revive dying economies and the fear that infections will rebound. This is really the most crucial time, said Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, and the most dangerous time. Well, the editorial said, as lockdowns lift, it's a time of confusion and boundary testing, said the Baltimore Sun. As people venture out, it's disappointing to see how quickly self-discipline exits stage right. Boardwalks and churches were far too crowded with maskless people, and police broke up dozens of illegal gatherings. Refusing to wear a mask or maintain distance for the common good doesn't make you a freedom fighter. It just makes you another statistic, a potential carrier of a virus against which there is no known cure. As we navigate these unfamiliar waters, we must be guided by real-world data, not computer models, said the Washington Examiner. Worst-case scenarios have shown their limits, fueling overblown fears about the collapse of the healthcare system. Solid data about how and where the virus is most likely to spread, in crowded indoor spaces but not outdoors, is what should be driving policy decisions. What the columnist said. There's a growing sense that we have to find a way to live with this thing, manage it the best we can, and muddle through, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. Vaccines are likely far off, and there aren't enough tests, but we can't become a nation of agoraphobics. With the help of masks, social distancing, and hand washing, we'll just have to live carefully. We're retreating to a new strategy, said Leanna Wynn in the Washington Post, so let's call it what it is. States are giving up on restrictions that drove down the number of new infections and have moved on to harm reduction. Since states are opening hair salons, gyms, and restaurants, we need to curtail the highest risk activities, such as crowded indoor fitness classes, and promote evidence-based practices, like keeping customers at least 6 feet apart, moving them outdoors when possible, and disinfecting shared spaces. Harm reduction is now our best hope for saving lives. This is not how healthy societies respond to a crisis, said Charlie Sykes in TheBulwark.com. President Trump's call for Americans to be warriors has been taken up by those who seem to have confused recklessness with courage and freedom with me-firstism. What we're seeing is the erosion of a culture that calls us all to a common purpose and sacrifice, a concept conservatives used to understand. It's hard to blame those who want to get on with their lives, but the right's disdain for masking, distancing, and the fear that risky behavior will spread the virus sends a clear message. We aren't all in this together anymore, are we? Second main story here. Watchdog investigating Pompeo fired in continuing purge. What happened? President Trump last week fired a watchdog official investigating a series of accusations against Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, the fifth inspector general fired or demoted by Trump since April. Steve Linick had been probing whether Pompeo ordered a federal employee to walk Pompeo's dog, make restaurant reservations, and pick up dry cleaning and takeout. Linick had also nearly finished an investigation into Pompeo's contentious decision last year to use an emergency declaration to push through billions of dollars in arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Pompeo reportedly refused to be interviewed by Linick, then denied knowing the substance of any of Linick's probes. Trump defended Pompeo, saying he might have been too busy to walk his dog and shouldn't have to wash dishes because maybe his wife isn't there. The dismissal comes as Pompeo faces scrutiny for leveraging his office in the service of future political ambitions. He and his wife, Susan, have held 20-plus black tie Madison dinners at the State Department, hosting CEOs, GOP lawmakers, and media heavyweights. Susan Pompeo also joined her husband on taxpayer-funded trips abroad and flights to their home state of Kansas. Pompeo denied that Linick's firing was retaliatory, but said Linick was not making the department better and that he should have been dismissed some time ago. An Obama appointee, Linick has upset administrations of both parties, most prominently with a scathing report about Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server while she served as Secretary of State. What the columnist said. Linick is the latest casualty of Trump's slow-motion Friday night massacre, said Aaron Blake in WashingtonPost.com. Trump ousted inspectors general at Health and Human Services and Transportation, both departments involved in the pandemic response, plus the Defense Department watchdog tapped to oversee distribution of Congress's $2 trillion relief package. He also fired the intelligence community inspector general who forwarded the whistleblower complaint that initiated Trump's impeachment. The war on inspectors general, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com, is the final front in Trump's war on any kind of check on the executive branch. It's no mystery why Trump is cleaning house, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. The president has been damaged by heinous allegations that have turned out to be either baseless or greatly exaggerated. inspectors general contributed significantly to that, feeding half-baked accusations to Congress. It would be better to reserve judgment before accusing Trump of political mischief. If Linick wasn't fired to hide the grime in Pompeo's State Department, then why don't Pompeo's explanations add up, asked Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. Pompeo is the latest in a long line of Trump officials who've used government resources to make their lives easier or more glamorous. Pompeo's security agents believed that they were treated like Uber Eats with guns. As Trump sacks his watchdogs, his vow to drain the swamp sounds ever more ludicrous. The controversy of the week is titled Obamagate, What It Really Means. President Trump's mounting anxiety about his re-election chances found expression last week in a single all-caps tweet, said Frank Rich in nymag.com. Obamagate. Trump himself can't quite explain the substance of his latest base-rousing conspiracy theory beyond calling it the biggest political crime and scandal in the history of the USA, by far. But thanks to blanket coverage of Trump's spokespeople and right-wing media, we know it involves President Barack Obama, then Vice President Joe Biden, and a shadowy cabal of deep state operatives who ginned up a phony Russia investigation and supposedly tricked Trump's National Security Advisor Michael Flynn into lying to the FBI. Obamagate is another ludicrously fake conspiracy theory from the man who built his political brand on birtherism, said Rick Wilson in thedailybeast.com. But it already has buy-in from Senate Republicans, who are readying subpoenas for FBI and intelligence officials involved in the Russia investigation. Meanwhile, Trump's enforcer, Attorney General William Barr, said this week that while he won't prosecute Biden or Obama, he has his sights set on key figures in the Russia probe, which Barr called a grave injustice unprecedented in American history. As November nears, the Obamagate show trials are coming. Obamagate is not a conspiracy theory, said David Harsanyi in nationalreview.com. We now know that the Russia probe was predicated on the Democrat-funded fabulism of the Steele dossier, and that Obama's Justice Department cut corners in FISA applications to spy on Trump campaign staff. A declassified memo from Obama advisor Susan Rice has revealed that eight officials, including Biden, requested that Michael Flynn's name be unmasked in classified transcripts of Flynn's call to the Russia ambassador. Since Biden won't explain why he personally unmasked Mr. Flynn, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, a full investigation is needed. That's laughable, said Michael Cohen in the Boston Globe. Flynn came under FBI scrutiny because he became a paid agent of Turkey while serving as a Trump campaign official and began frequently making phone calls to Russians as he sought to undermine U.S. sanctions designed to punish Russia for its illegal efforts to get Trump elected. Besides, the process of unmasking not only is routine, Trump's own officials unmasked names in intelligence reports 7,700 times last year, but also involves revealing a name that the unmasker didn't know previously. The idea that anyone targeted Flynn for unmasking is absurd, since Obama officials didn't know who kept calling the Russian ambassador. As for Susan Rice's supposedly damning memo, said Mark von Rennenkampf in TheHill.com, it actually proves the opposite of what Trump wants it to. Rice explicitly documents Obama's insistence that the FBI conduct the investigation by the book and that he was not asking about, initiating, or instructing anything related to that investigation. It's clear what Obamagate really means, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. That's Trump's name for the crimes he's trying to commit himself. The use of the Justice Department as a weapon to protect his friends and harass his rivals. Trump's obsession with Obama plays well with his base, said Susan Glasser in NewYorker.com. But it won't distract most voters from the president's catastrophic pandemic response. In his growing panic, Trump is simply returning to his comfort zone of Obama hatred, like a child retreating to his bedroom and hiding under the blanket. We'll move into our good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for seduction after police captured a male peacock that had escaped from a Boston zoo by playing mating calls on an officer's smartphone. I feel guilty for deceiving him, said Officer Patrick Sullivan. I know the dating scene right now in Boston is a challenge. It was a good week for passionate support after a South Korean soccer team seated life-size sex dolls around its home stadium to compensate for the absence of fans. FC Seoul said it had intended to use premium mannequins, but had a misunderstanding with the supplier. It was a good week for winnowing after the Dutch National Institute for Public Health advised single people to find and largely confine themselves to one sex buddy or sex buddy for the duration of the pandemic. The more people you see, reasoned the institute, the greater the chance of spreading coronavirus. But it was a bad week for the apple under the tree. After Eric Trump told Fox News Sunday that Democrats had invented the pandemic to ruin the economy and his dad's rallies, and that after Election Day, the coronavirus will magically all of a sudden go away and disappear. It was a bad week for the boys of summer after Major League Baseball said that if and when the season begins in empty stadiums, players will need to submit to frequent nasal swab tests and refrain from spitting, high-fiving each other, and chewing on sunflower seeds. Finally, it was a bad week for working from home after a Wall Street banker blasted his junior employees for not immediately responding to his 3 a.m. email. I sleep an average of 5 hours or less, the executive at PJT Partners wrote. I expect the same or more from my junior team. We're on the briefing page, titled this week, How Pandemics Change Society. The Black Death, the Spanish Flu, and other widespread disease outbreaks have transformed how people live. Will COVID-19 change the world? Yes, if it's similar to the pandemics of the past. Plagues and viral contagions have regularly blighted the course of human civilization, killing millions of people and wreaking economic devastation. But as each pandemic receded, it left cultural, political, and social changes that lasted far beyond the disease itself. The great outbreaks of history, including the Athenian plague, the Black Death, and the Spanish flu, transformed healthcare, economics, religion, the way we socialize, and the way we work. Things are never the same after a pandemic as they were before, said Dr. Liam Fox, a former UK defense secretary who's studied these outbreaks for a forthcoming book. The current outbreak will be no exception. When was the first pandemic? The earliest on record occurred during the Peloponnesian War in 430 BC, now believed to have been a form of typhoid fever. That particular plague passed through Libya, Ethiopia, and Egypt before striking the city of Athens, then under siege by Sparta. Thucydides chronicled Athens' misery in lucid detail, writing of sufferers' lesions, red skin and bloody throats and tongues, and the apocalyptic scenes within the city's walls as dying men lay tumbling one upon another in the streets. The plague would ultimately play a large part in Athens' eventual defeat by Sparta, and the sense of despair led to a surge in licentiousness among the population. In many pandemics across the ages, people have taken refuge in sex and drinking, as well as in increased religiosity. The Justinian plague of AD 541 fueled the rapid rise of Christianity throughout the Mediterranean. What caused the Justinian plague? Yersinia pestis, a bacterium spread by fleas on rodents, the same culprit behind one of the worst pandemics in human history, the Black Death. Arriving in Sicily on a trading ship in 1347, the Black Death eventually spread throughout Europe and wiped out about 200 million people, up to 60% of the global population. People died horribly, afflicted with terrible aches, vomiting, and pus and blood-filled buboes on their armpits and groins. As the Black Death swept through Europe, it did, however, force authorities to institute health measures that remain in place today. 14th century Venice ordered mandated isolation periods, named 40 giorni, or quarantine in English, to signify the 40 days of isolation imposed on incoming ships. Routine medical inspections became customary, and hospitals were built throughout Europe to treat the sick. What other impact did it have? The Black Death's biggest socio-economic legacy was its role in ending feudalism. Feudalism was a medieval system that empowered wealthy nobles to grant the use of their land to peasants in exchange for their labor, with rent, wages, and other terms determined by the lords. By wiping out a huge swath of the working population, the Black Death created a labor shortage that gave peasants the leverage to negotiate new working terms, effectively bringing about the end of serfdom and paving the way for modern capitalism. What about other epidemics? In 1802, an outbreak of yellow fever in the French colony of Saint-Domingue, now Haiti, triggered a chain of events that led to the vast expansion of the United States. The epidemic, caused by a virus transmitted by mosquitoes, killed an estimated 50,000 French troops trying to control Haiti, forcing France to withdraw. The loss of this key Caribbean outpost was so economically damaging to France that Napoleon sold off 828,000 square miles of French territory in North America, extending from New Orleans to Canada, to President Thomas Jefferson, for a mere $15 million, the Louisiana Purchase. That may have been the most consequential outbreak in the history of the Americas until the Spanish flu erupted in 1918. What was the Spanish flu? It was a virulent strain of H1N1 influenza that may have actually originated on a Kansas poultry farm. One of its first victims was a U.S. soldier stationed in Kansas. Unlike the bacterial plagues of the past, the Spanish flu was a virus, which became more deadly when it picked up some genetic material from a virus infecting birds. Spreading like wildfire among soldiers in the trenches of France and Belgium and then around the globe, the pandemic influenced the course of the First World War and arguably contributed to the Second, says science journalist Laurie Spinney, author of a book on the Spanish flu. The virus killed approximately 50 million people worldwide, including 675,000 Americans. Among those struck down were a number of American delegates to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, many of whom were opposed to making German reparations a condition of the Treaty of Versailles. With the Americans missing, delegates approved the punishing reparations, and the humiliation Germans felt was a key contributor to Hitler's rise. Like the Black Death, the Spanish flu revolutionized public health, spawning the new fields of epidemiology and virology. It led several Western European countries to adopt universal health care systems that are still in operation. The Spanish flu, says Spinney, resculpated human populations. COVID-19's possible legacy. The coronavirus has already had a huge and potentially enduring impact on everyday life. Our work and social lives have gone virtual, with even G7 leaders conducting their meetings via video conferencing. Movie studios, gyms, musicians, and karaoke bars are streaming their content straight into our homes. The outbreak has revived impassioned debates about the U.S. healthcare system, possibly offering a boon for those in favor of universal coverage. And it may have an even wider geopolitical legacy. The Spanish flu and the economic depression that followed it led to a wave of nationalism, authoritarianism, and another world war. Science journalist Laura Spinney says the same could happen in the aftermath of the coronavirus, reversing the tide of globalization and fueling xenophobia at a time when countries should be united against a common viral enemy. We've forgotten a lot of the lessons that we learned after the Spanish flu and other pandemics, Spinney says. We may be about to learn them again. Moving into some of the best columns of the week, we'll start with Barr's blatant partisanship. Attorney General William Barr has openly enlisted as an arm of the Trump campaign, said former Deputy Attorney General Donald Ayer. Barr's gross abuses of his office began a year ago with his whitewashing of the Mueller report. He's grown more brazenly partisan over time, and his abuse of the Justice Department's power in order to defend President Trump and threaten his adversaries raises unprecedented perils for our democratic system. His recent motion to dismiss charges against former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn denied undisputed facts, including that Flynn lied to the FBI about secret conversations with the Russia ambassador. Barr has called Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation one of the greatest travesties in American history, and he is personally overseeing a criminal probe of the CIA and FBI officials who Barr says sought to sabotage Trump. Commenting on an open investigation is a blatant violation of the Justice Department rules, but Barr has already claimed Obama administration officials broke the law and will be held to account. His transparently partisan conduct paints a clear picture of what is to come. As November nears, Barr intends to use the Justice Department to damage Donald Trump's adversaries and help ensure his reelection. This comes from Russia. The leader who refuses to lead. President Vladimir Putin has washed his hands of Russia's coronavirus crisis, says Mark Gagliotti. This country has the world's second fastest rate of infection, behind only the U.S., and the official death toll of some 2,700 is clearly severely understated. Yet Putin last week gave up an upbeat speech announcing the end of six-week national non-working period. His euphemism for a lockdown in which employees continued to pay workers' salaries. That doesn't mean all quarantines will be lifted. Regional governors, not the president, will now decide what can and can't reopen. Putin is relinquishing the terrible responsibility of handling the pandemic, but retaining all the perks of power. This buck passing is sure to end in disaster because governors lack both the money and the access to scientific expertise needed to combat the disease. But it does have the advantage of allowing Putin to skirt blame. He gets to force all the hard decisions on local leaders, demanding they both save lives and save the economy, while sniping at them from the sidelines. Meanwhile, he sits atop a rainy day reserve of $600 billion, refusing to hand out any cash to states. The message is clear. Although Putin created a centralized political system, he is not going to be the commander-in-chief of this war. This is a How They See Us international column. Abandoning the WHO to China. The World Health Organization has become a battleground in the clash between the U.S. and China, said Mark McKinnon in the Globe and Mail from Canada. The UN agency's annual meeting was held remotely this year, but U.S. President Donald Trump still didn't attend. Instead, Health Secretary Alex Azar teleconferenced into lambast WHO for not demanding more transparency from China when the pandemic started late last year. That failure, he said, cost many lives. The Trump administration has already punished WHO by suspending U.S. funding for the body, some $400 million a year, more than any other country provides. But the U.S. has few allies in this fight. Ahead of the meeting, it supported a sharply worded Australian proposal for a probe that would have sent an independent inspection team to the Chinese city of Wuhan, where the virus originated. But after China threatened to boycott Australian beef, Australia instead backed a vaguer European Union proposal for an impartial inquiry into WHO's pandemic response. Chinese President Xi Jinping, meanwhile, appeared magnanimous, promising $2 billion to help countries battle COVID-19. Trump's only offering was a letter to WHO boss Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus that bemoaned the agency's alarming dependence on China and warned it had 30 days to reform or see the U.S. withdraw from the organization. That letter was riddled with factual errors, said Patrick Wintour in The Guardian. Trump claimed, for example, that Taiwan had warned WHO about human-to-human transmission on December 31st, when in fact Taiwan had merely asked about reports that Wuhan residents were being isolated after falling sick with a mysterious pneumonia. Trump also claimed that British medical journal The Lancet had reported on the virus in late 2019. The Lancet responded that it had published no such report. Trump is desperately trying to divert attention from his own failure, said the Global Times in China. He wasted the precious months that China's Wuhan lockdown bought him and did not prepare his country with masks, ventilators, or testing and tracing capacity. More than 90,000 Americans are dead because of his administration's laziness, although Trump wants the world to believe China and WHO are the true culprits. But manipulating the international community is not as easy as Washington thought, as proved by Australia's wise retreat on its call for an investigation into China's handling of the virus. In fact, Beijing has much to answer for, said Frederick Burg in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung from Germany. Chinese authorities initially masked the virus outbreak and are still reluctant to provide data, virus material, and information to other nations. But Trump has no standing to criticize WHO's early praise of China's response to the virus. After all, the U.S. president tweeted in January that his country greatly appreciates China's efforts and transparency. The planet needs a robust WHO. Does Trump really want to leave the body and cede global health leadership to China? And we'll turn right over to the last word, our feature article, titled, When is a Pandemic Over? Throughout human history, plagues have ebbed as unpredictably as they began, said Gina Colata in the New York Times. Deciding when life can go back to normal may not be just a medical question. When will the COVID-19 pandemic end? And how? According to historians, pandemics typically have two types of endings. The medical, which occurs when the incidence and death rates plummet, and the social, when the epidemic of fear about the disease wanes. When people ask, when will this end, they are asking about the social ending, said Dr. Jeremy Green, a historian of medicine at Johns Hopkins. In other words, an end can occur not because a disease has been vanquished, but because people grow tired of panic mode and learn to live with the disease. Alan Brandt, a Harvard historian, said something similar is happening with COVID-19. As we have seen in the debate about opening the economy, many questions about the so-called end are determined not by medical and public health data, but by socio-political processes. Endings are very, very messy, said Dora Varga, a historian at the University of Exeter. Looking back, we have a weak narrative. For whom does the epidemic end, and who gets to say? An epidemic of fear can occur even without an epidemic of illness. Dr. Susan Murray of the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin saw that firsthand in 2014 when she was a fellow at a rural hospital in Ireland. In the preceding months, more than 11,000 people in West Africa had died from Ebola, a terrifying and highly infectious viral disease. The epidemic seemed to be waning, and no cases had occurred in Ireland, but the public fear was palpable. On the street and on the wards, people are anxious, Murray recalled recently in an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. Having the wrong color skin is enough to earn you the side eye from your fellow passengers on the bus or train. Cough once, and you will find them shuffling away from you. The Dublin hospital workers were warned to prepare for the worst. They were terrified and worried that they lacked protective equipment. When a young man arrived in the emergency room from a country with Ebola patients, no one wanted to go near him. Nurses hid and doctors threatened to leave the hospital. Murray alone dared to treat him, she wrote, but his cancer was so advanced that all she could do was comfort care. A few days later, tests confirmed that the man did not have Ebola. He died an hour later. 3 days afterward, the World Health Organization declared the Ebola epidemic over. Murray wrote, "If we are not prepared to fight fear and ignorance as actively and as thoughtfully as we fight any other virus, it is possible that fear can do terrible harm to vulnerable people, even in places that never see a single case of infection during an outbreak. And a fear epidemic can have far worse consequences when complicated by issues of race, privilege, and language." Bubonic plague has struck several times in the past 2,000 years, killing millions of people and altering the course of history. Each epidemic amplified the fear that came with the next outbreak. The disease is caused by a strain of bacteria, Yersinia pestis, that lives on fleas that live on rats. But the plague, which became known as the Black Death, also can be passed from infected person to infected person through respiratory droplets, so it cannot be eradicated simply by killing rats. Historians describe three great waves of plague, said Mary Fassell, a historian at Johns Hopkins, the Justinian Plague in the 6th century, the medieval epidemic in the 14th century, and a pandemic that struck in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The medieval pandemic began in 1331 in China. The illness, along with a civil war that was raging at the time, killed half the population of China. From there, the plague moved along trade routes to Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. In the years between 1347 and 1351, it killed at least one-third of the European population. Half the population of Siena, Italy, died. "It is impossible for the human tongue to recount the awful truth," wrote 14th century chronicler Agnolo de Turra. "Indeed, one who did not see such horribleness can be called blessed. The infected, he wrote, swell beneath the armpits and in their groins and fall over while talking. The dead were buried in pits, in piles. In Florence, Italy, wrote Giovanni Boccaccio, no more respect was accorded to dead people than would nowadays be accorded to dead goats. Some hid in their homes. Others refused to accept the threat. Their way of coping, Boccaccio wrote, was to drink heavily, enjoy life to the full, go round singing and merrymaking, and gratify all of one's cravings when the opportunity emerged, and shrug the whole thing off as one enormous joke. That pandemic ended, but the plague recurred. One of the worst outbreaks began in China in 1855 and spread worldwide, killing more than 12 million in India alone. Health authorities in Mumbai, India, burned whole neighborhoods trying to rid them of the plague. Nobody knew if it made a difference, Yale historian Frank Snowden said. It is not clear what made the bubonic plague die down. Some scholars have argued that cold weather killed the disease-carrying fleas, but that would not have interrupted the spread by respiratory route, Snowden noted. Or perhaps it was a change in the rats. By the 19th century, the plague was being carried not by black rats, but by brown rats, which are stronger, more vicious, and more likely to live apart from humans. You certainly wouldn't want one for a pet, Snowden said. Another hypothesis is that the bacterium evolved to be less deadly. Or maybe actions by humans, such as burning of villages, helped quell the epidemic. The plague never really went away. In the United States, infections are endemic among prairie dogs in the Southwest and can be transmitted to people. Snowden said that one of his friends became infected after a stay at a hotel in New Mexico. The previous occupant of his room had a dog, which had fleas that carried the microbe. Such cases are rare and can now successfully be treated with antibiotics. But any report of a case of the plague stirs up fear. Among the diseases to have come to a medical end is smallpox, but it is exceptional for several reasons. There is an effective vaccine, which gives lifelong protection. The virus, variola minor, has no animal host, so eliminating the disease in humans meant total elimination. And its symptoms are so unusual that infection is obvious, allowing for effective quarantines and contact tracing. But while it raged, smallpox was horrific. Epidemic after epidemic swept the world for at least 3,000 years. Individuals infected with the virus developed a fever, then a rash that turned into pus-filled spots, which became encrusted and fell off, leaving scars. The disease killed 3 out of 10 of its victims, often after immense suffering. In 1633, an epidemic among Native Americans disrupted all the Native communities in the Northeast and certainly facilitated English settlement in Massachusetts, said Harvard historian David Jones. William Bradford, leader of the Plymouth Colony, wrote an account of the disease in Native Americans, saying the broken pustules would effectively glue a patient's skin to the mat he lay on, only to be torn off. Bradford wrote, when they turn them, a whole side will flay off at once, as it were, and they will be all of a gore blood, most fearful to behold. The last person to contract smallpox naturally was Ali Mau Malin, a hospital cook in Somalia in 1977. He recovered, only to die of malaria in 2013. The 2018 flu is held up today as the example of the ravages of a pandemic and the value of quarantines and social distancing. Before it ended, the flu killed 50 million to 100 million people worldwide. It preyed on young to middle-aged adults, orphaning children, depriving families of breadwinners, killing troops in the midst of World War I. In the autumn of 1918, William Vaughan, a prominent doctor, was dispatched to Camp Devens near Boston to report on a flu that was raging there. He saw hundreds of stalwart young men in the uniform of their country coming out of the wards of the hospitals in groups of 10 or more, he wrote. They are placed on cots until every bed is full, yet others crowd in. Their faces soon wear a bluish cast. A distressing cough brings up blood-stained sputum. In the morning, the dead bodies are stacked in the morgue like cordwood. The virus, Vaughn wrote, demonstrated the inferiority of human inventions in the destruction of human life. After sweeping through the world, that flu faded away, evolving into a variant of the more benign flu that comes around every year. Maybe it was like a fire that, having burned the available and easily accessible wood, burns down, Snowden said. It ended socially, too. World War I was over. People were ready for a fresh start, a new era, and eager to put the nightmare of disease and war behind them. Until recently, the 1918 flu was largely forgotten. Other flu pandemics followed, none so bad, but all nonetheless sobering. In the Hong Kong flu of 1968, 1 million people died worldwide, including 100,000 in the United States, mostly people older than 65. That virus still circulates as a seasonal flu, and its initial path of destruction and the fear that went with it is rarely recalled. Will that happen with COVID-19? One possibility, historians say, is that the coronavirus pandemic could end socially before it ends medically. People may grow so tired of the restrictions that they declare the pandemic over, even as the virus continues to smolder in the population and before a vaccine or effective treatment is found. I think there is this sort of social psychological issue of exhaustion and frustration, Yale historian Naomi Rogers said. We may be in a moment when people are just saying, that's enough. I deserve to be able to return to my regular life. It is happening already. In some states, governors have lifted restrictions, allowing hair salons, nail salons, and gyms to reopen, in defiance of warnings by public health officials that such steps are premature. As the economic catastrophe wreaked by the lockdown grows, more and more people may be ready to say enough. There is this sort of conflict now, Rogers said. Public health officials have a medical end in sight, but some members of the public see a social end. Who gets to claim the end? Rogers said. If you push back against the notion of its ending, what are you pushing back against? What are you claiming when you say, no, it is not ending? The challenge, Brandt said, is that there will be no sudden victory. Trying to define the end of a pandemic will be a long and difficult process. This article originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The comic actor who spun gold from oblivion, Fred Willard, 1933 to 2020. Nobody made cluelessness funnier than Fred Willard. He performed hundreds of movie and TV roles in his long career, but hit his apex in a series of largely improvised mockumentaries, most directed by Christopher Guest, playing dunderheaded characters who matched ardent sincerity with unwitting ridiculousness. Cast as dog show announcer Buck McLaughlin in 2000's Best in Show, he breezily muses on miniature schnauzers. You'd think they'd want to breed them bigger. In 1996's Waiting for Guffman, he's a travel agent with showbiz aspirations cast in a small-town theater production. As an Air Force officer in 1984's This is Spinal Tap, he welcomes the titular metal band to a military base while effusing that he's a big fan, not of yours personally, but the whole genre of rock and roll. Willard said it was a joy to inhabit a character who has no cares and is oblivious to everything. It's a kind of release. It's the kind of character I would love to be. He was born in Shaker Heights, Ohio, the son of a stern father who worked in a bank, said the Los Angeles Times. As a child, he fell in love with sketch comedy after seeing the 1950s vaudeville silliness of bandleader Spike Jones and the City Slickers. Sent away to military school as a teenager, his heart was always in show business, and following a stint in the Army, Willard moved to New York City to train as an actor. He took serious roles, said the Washington Post, but ran into a problem while appearing in a Tennessee Williams play. His line readings inadvertently made audiences laugh. Willard embraced comedy, said the New York Times, and spent a year in Chicago with the improv troupe Second City. In 1966, he made his TV debut on the short-lived Western sitcom Pistols and Petticoats. More bit parts followed, but it wasn't until 1977 that he grabbed the spotlight playing Jerry Hubbard, the dim-witted, eager sidekick of a small-town talk show host in Fernwood Tonight. He'd clocked more than 700 roles over the next four decades, scoring Emmy nominations for turns in the sitcoms Everybody Loves Raymond and Modern Family. But it was in the improv-heavy mockumentaries that his comic talent truly shone. Everyone has a little trap door in their mind where you go to say something, and then you think, no, you shouldn't say this, Willard said of his skill for spontaneous deadpan stupidity. I just opened that door. And we'll go on over to the Talking Points page where we do find that article that the cover drawing referred to. It's titled, Cities, Will the Great Exodus Be Permanent? Get me out of here. That's the cry of many residents of America's biggest cities as they respond to the coronavirus pandemic by loading up their SUVs and heading for the hills, said Jessica Minton in USAtoday.com. Real estate brokers say they've had a surge in requests from city dwellers looking for rentals elsewhere. And in New York City alone, the data shows that at least 420,000 have moved out, mostly from the wealthier zip codes. A national poll found one-third of city folk are mulling a move to the suburbs, small towns, or rural areas. College professor Lee Sean Huang, 39, has lived in New York City for 14 years, but grew weary of being caged in a small apartment as lockdowns shuttered the restaurants, bars, clubs, and cultural venues that made city life worthwhile. Now that he can work remotely, he's moved to a rental 90 miles away on eastern Long Island. It's a shift in priorities, he said, to having space. Big cities such as New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago had already been losing population before the pandemic, said Parag Khanna and Kalish Prasad in Politico.com. Now Americans may have reached a turning point in where most prefer to live. Many workers have been liberated from offices, and employers may not require them to come back. Workers who've temporarily relocated to smaller towns are finding they like the space, access to nature, and cheaper cost of living. So why return? As Silicon Valley venture capitalist Balaji Srinivasan put it in a pithy tweet, sell city, buy country. History suggests they'll be back, said Catherine Shilchet and Athena Jones and CNN.com. After 9/11, 4,500 people fled lower Manhattan, which was shrouded in the Twin Towers' toxic dust. But residents returned in droves in the ensuing years amid a housing boom in lower Manhattan. Disease outbreaks don't end cities, said Nicholas Monchot in the New York Times, but they do transform them. The fear that bad air caused malaria inspired New York's Central Park and Boston's Emerald Necklace. Already, Seattle, San Francisco, and Oakland have turned miles of roads into public promenades. This is smart not just now, but permanently. More wide-open public spaces will enhance the health, welfare, and equality of our cities for decades to come. And we've got time for a few of the shorter notes. President Barack Obama's White House left the Trump administration an intricate 69-page playbook for fighting pandemics. The plan includes a recommendation that the federal government take the lead in coordinating the response and rely on a single spokesperson to provide consistent messaging to the public, with decision charts about when to shore up strategic stockpiles of personal protective equipment. The coronavirus has hit nearly every corner of the U.S., but not all. Of America's 3,143 counties, 231 had not registered a single case as of May 15. Some 44% are in the Midwest, and Texas has the most at 34. In largely rural North Dakota and Montana, at least one in four counties is free of cases. More than 100,000 crew members are stuck on cruise ships without pay because of border and port closures. At least 578 cruise ship crew members have contracted COVID-19, and seven have died. And we'll finish out today with a quote from Mark Twain, quoted in TheBulwark.com, who says, "It is curious that physical courage should be so common in the world and moral courage so rare." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.